I'm Matthew Smith, Vermont Edition producer, and I wanted to let you know that the podcast you're about to listen to has been edited for clarity and brevity. Thanks for listening and enjoy.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Michaela Lafrac. We're joined today by Health Commissioner Dr. Mark Levine. He's going to help us sort through the most recent updates to Vermont's COVID-19 response. Dr. Levine, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Michaela.
All right, Dr. Levine, let's start with the numbers. Now, the state's COVID-19 dashboard didn't update yesterday because of the MLK holiday, but just before today's show, we got some new numbers in. So can you walk us through where we are today, starting with case rates?
Sure. Case numbers are obviously a little challenging during weekends and holidays, so they may not be totally representative of where we are at this point in time, but certainly the last several days, the cases were down at 806 on Sunday and 715 on Monday, which are much lower than some of the numbers we've been seeing, obviously, in the 2,000 range in days before. Now, the fact of the matter is, our percent positivity rate hasn't really budged in quite a number of days. It's at a little over 12, high 12, low 13% range, which is the best in the country, actually. Doesn't mean that we should look at it as a totally reliable number because of the fact that the higher your percent positivity, more likely the situation is that you're just not doing enough testing. Now, we know we're doing abundant testing in Vermont because we lead the country in that as well. So this number may be somewhat more reflective in Vermont of reality compared to other states.
And sorry, but Dr. Levine, when you say that we lead the country in testing, does that mean testing per capita, total tests run? What exact number are you referring to?
Yeah, testing per capita.
Okay.
And the reality is, as we all know, around the country and in Vermont, we're transitioning towards more of an antigen test based platform right now, though there are obviously still abundant numbers of people getting tested at our PCR sites. But with the antigen testing, we of course don't always know the denominator of how many people chose to get tested. We rarely know who tested negative, and uncommonly we know who tested positive. So we know people are reporting on our website. We don't think that's a super high percentage of the total. And so just the idea of knowing how many cases you're dealing with in any given state is a challenge now. Often people estimate the true number of people who are infected at any given point in time are four or five times that what you're seeing in your daily counts.
And I should also note, when I was looking at the dashboard today, that I saw that we're currently at 499 deaths to COVID-19, which is clearly the cusp of a pretty terrible milestone, 500 deaths. I'm curious, Dr. Levine, how that number strikes you.
Oh, it's terrible and tragic, no question about it. Keep in mind now it's over 2+ years of collecting this kind of data. But the reality is each death is obviously yet another tragedy. The fact of the matter is, as long as we have COVID, just like as long as we've had flu, we will have deaths that occur. And that's just the harsh reality of winter respiratory illnesses and the impact on a population, especially on an older population like we have in northern New England.
Now, let's look a little bit more closely at those hospitalization numbers. As of today, as of Tuesday, we have hit an all-time record for Vermonters hospitalized due to COVID with 116 people, I believe it was, that are hospitalized right now. How do you parse that number? How should people understand it when they hear it?
Yes, that's a correct number. We've been in the 90s to low hundreds for most of the last week. So this is a higher number. It is a little bit volatile. It goes up and down with the given day. But that number, obviously, when you look at the number of beds around the state, is probably around 10% of people in the hospital are in the hospital with a COVID-associated illness. Now, we were able to learn just yesterday for the first time, because there's been some interest in this, looking at how many people are in the hospital for COVID as opposed to how many are in the hospital with COVID, meaning that they were admitted for another reason, but also had COVID either at the time they got in or just tested positive as they were being admitted to the hospital. And it turns out about 70% were hospitalized for COVID and 30% were hospitalized with COVID as recently as yesterday. And that's reporting from about three quarters of the hospitals in Vermont. So that gives us some perspective. And certainly, to me, it just verifies the fact that there are indeed a lot of people being admitted who don't have COVID as their primary diagnosis, but there's also plenty who are. And that's what we would expect to see at this point in time. Now, you didn't mention the ICU number, Michaela, so I'll just bring that up as well.
Please.
There were 26 in the ICU as of 11 o'clock this morning. And that number is not a record either. Generally, it's been in the 20s pretty consistently of late. That, again, represents about a quarter of the ICU beds in Vermont. And if you look at how many people are in an ICU and on a ventilator, there are only six. So again, maybe it's Omicron. We're seeing people who require ICU care, but at the same time, we're not seeing abundant people on ventilators now or really at any point during this pandemic. You may recall ventilators were a big topic of discussion in the first 6 months of COVID, and that has not been the challenge by any means. Having said that, we also have over a dozen ICU beds available in the state right now. So we're certainly pushing the envelope, but we're not at a true crisis with regard to the ICU beds.
Well, the point you make about ventilators is interesting because I do think there's this kind of disconnect between one message that we're hearing, which is that Omicron is, you know, leads to more mild illness than with different variants. Yet we're seeing hospitalization surge and we're hearing about these record hospitalization numbers. And I think some folks might be confused about how those kind of two facts can coexist.
Yes, well, Omicron specifically, some of the basic science research going on indicates it may have a little less predilection to damaging the lungs than previous variants, including Delta for sure. So that may be part of the explanation. But again, overall, we have incredible ways of dealing with respiratory distress now for the SARS-CoV-2 virus. And hospitals are able to take advantage of many modalities of ventilating people without actually putting them on a ventilator itself, using various high-flow nasal cannula oxygen regimens and other non-invasive forms of helping people breathe. So that becomes much less of an issue. And we've just learned over time in these last 2 years in a much more sophisticated way, how to help people, how to support people's ventilation without necessarily having to put them on a mechanical ventilator.
Now, let's go to the phones. We're getting lots of calls in, as we always do when you're on, Dr. Levine. Let's start with Jason in Westminster. Jason, you are on the air. What's your question or comment for Dr. Levine?
Hi, thanks for taking my call. My question is, why is there little to no talk about outpatient care with people that test positive for COVID? In other words, early treatment. We're tackling COVID as people, this is the way that it seems to everybody, as people are going into the hospital, but not doing anything to prevent that from happening. When there are treatments out there, like monoclonal antibodies, ivermectin, or, you know, what people like to call horse pace that has worked in countries all over the world, why aren't we trying to prevent people from going into the hospital in the first place?
And Dr. Levine, before you answer that question, I also want to add a email from Kylie in Swanton, who asks, as a severely immunocompromised Vermonter, I'm desperately hoping to receive the recently FDA-approved AstraZeneca monoclonal cocktail called Evusheld, I believe it's pronounced. They write that it's designed for pre-exposure to COVID. And they ask, what is the Department of Health doing to pressure the federal government to increase the number of doses they purchased? I understand Vermont only received about 100 doses. So Dr. Levine, lots of questions in here about treatments and about early treatments. What's your response?
Yeah, these are great questions. Let me start with the first caller, because certainly his view of we're not doing anything and nobody's getting treatment is not correct. The bottom line is, with Omicron, we're finding many, many people are less symptomatic, and so when you have these higher caseloads, many of the individuals don't really require any treatment to prevent hospitalization and don't require some of these valuable treatment resources we have that are in scarce supply. The fact is, the people who should really immediately, when they get symptoms or when they get a positive test result, be thinking about needing treatment and be connected with their healthcare professional are those who have mild to moderate illness and a serious risk factor for hospitalization, and a risk factor that would make COVID a more serious illness in them, which includes the second caller, somebody who's immunocompromised, which includes anybody in the elderly age range, includes people who have any of the diagnoses, actually, that may have qualified them to get their vaccine ahead of others as a priority. So that's a whole host of illnesses. So we want all of those individuals to be connected with their healthcare provider immediately, even if they don't feel that they're that ill, just because they are at risk of getting more severely ill. And I've been broadcasting that very widely each week at the press conferences and every chance I get. Now, in terms of the actual treatments, monoclonal antibodies has been the leading treatment available to this point in time. Unfortunately, with the Omicron variant, there's only one of the monoclonal antibodies that is effective. And some of the ones we were using previously, we've had to discontinue using. But the one that's effective is sotrovimab. And that is, again, in scarce supply, but we are using every bit that we can get that comes into the state and deploying it in a very regional fashion so that Vermonters, no matter where they live, would be able to access it. There are now oral medications. The most important one is Paxlovid because it has such high efficacy against preventing hospitalization. And the second is molnupiravir, which has slightly less efficacy. Each of those are also available now. And we've been able to send them to drive-through pharmacies so that they're easy to access once person has got the prescription. The problem with the Paxlovid, which is the most effective of all of these treatments and which would really be the first line, is that we're not getting substantial numbers of doses yet. It's not Vermont's fault. It's not our lack of advocacy with the government. It's a very fair allocation regime that the government has had across all states and territories. It's just that there's not enough in the manufacturing pipeline to take care of all the need.
And our caller, Jason, asked us about ivermectin. We get a question about ivermectin pretty much every week when you're on, Dr. Levine, but I do want to pause here and take a moment for you to respond. Ivermectin is, of course, an anti-parasite. Some say it should be used to treat COVID-19. What are your comments there?
Yes, well, the caller's correct that there are places around the world that are using it a lot. We're finding there are places in the United States that are actually using it. And in today's news, there's report of a lawsuit by several inmates from another state because they were complaining, a state in the South, that the jail that they were in was giving them ivermectin as part of a cocktail of treatments. And they felt that it caused some severe side effects in them, and they now have a lawsuit. But the bottom line in the U.S. is that we try to be evidence-based in our approach, and the evidence has just not been judged sufficient to warrant the use of this drug as a first-line or even second- or third-line drug in the treatment of COVID.
So just sorry, to be clear there, is ivermectin being used in Vermont to treat COVID-19 at this time?
If it is, it's being used on an individual physician-to-patient pattern.
Okay.
So I wouldn't really have any awareness on that. But we're not recommending it be used. And unfortunately, people have been using it both as a treatment and a preventive, and sometimes self-dosing in ways that can cause some very serious side effects. And that precipitated a tweet by the FDA basically telling people not to do that. You're not an animal. You don't take this drug. It is used in humans, as you point out, in a very small number of indications that have to do with parasitic diseases.
Let's go now to...
I should answer the second caller's question.
Oh, please, they asked about... Yes, that's the recently FDA-approved AstraZeneca monoclonal cocktail. How is that being used, if it is?
So this is a long-acting treatment, and it's... could be effective for up to 6 months. It's injected into the muscle. It's called Evusheld. It's again, on the same line of thinking of monoclonal antibodies. And it basically is about 100 doses a week, which is not a lot, considering how many people may have some kind of immunocompromising condition, or cancer treatment, or other treatments that can suppress the immune system. So we've had to be very much using a system that tries to be fair to everyone and not deny it to anyone, but have them be on a list so that they may get it eventually. Unlike the treatments that we just discussed, which you should get in the first 5 days of illness, obviously, this more preventive medication can be given at any time, but of course, the best time would be when you're in the midst of a surge of a new variant like Omicron. So we're trying to get it to as many people as possible. I just wish we could get more. It's, again, not a weakness in the state of Vermont or our advocacy. It's just the hard facts of life in terms of these novel therapies coming online in a sufficiently robust way that we can get them out to all the people that would benefit from them.
Well, thank you for explaining there. It sounds like one more effect of larger supply chain issues that seem to be affecting every part of our society these days. Jen in Burlington. Jen, you're on the air. What's your question or comment for Dr. Levine?
Hi, Dr. Levine. I have a two-part question. For those who have had COVID, particularly within the last 3 months, and they need to provide a negative test before returning to work or school, which test do they use? And secondly, and does this answer change if they are unvaccinated?
Okay, so the point to make on the first question, when you need to provide a negative test and you've had COVID within the three-month window, is that there's a strong possibility, depending on where you are in that 3 months, that the traditional PCR test will still be sensitive enough to test positive. It's probably picking up fragments of viral nucleic acid, but having said that, it's so sensitive that it can do that. So it would be a poor choice for the first test. And generally, showing that you've had evidence for a positive PCR within that 3 months should satisfy those who are looking to you to be able to sort of return with a test result, because you just can't honor that. If they really push, an antigen test could be utilized because it is a surrogate for trying to tell if you are infectious at the time. And if you're totally resolved from your previous illness, your antigen test should be negative. They may not accept that test, but it's really the only test that you could use to provide them with that information. And your vaccination status shouldn't matter at that point in time if they're requiring the test within the 3-month window.
Thanks for your call, Jen. Let's go to another caller in Burlington. Flip, you are on the air. What's your question or comment for Dr. Levine today?
Thank you, Dr. Levine, for your service to all of us during the pandemic. I received 2 boxes, 4 tests of the QuickVue at-home test provided by the state government. Unfortunately, they were delivered Sunday when I was not expecting them and was not notified, and so they sat out in very cold weather for more than 12 hours. The box says store between 59 and 86 degrees. Are they still valid?
And Dr. Levine, during the governor's press conference last week, I remember you saying you were trying to learn more from the test manufacturers about whether that extreme cold could affect all of these tests that have been getting mailed to Vermonters across the state over the past week. So what have you learned?
Yes, and it's not just Vermonters. You know, there's other parts of the country that are getting cold as well now.
That's true.
And there are lots of tests being mailed through similar programs to people's homes. So this is really a very general interest. Obviously, we can't prevent the cold and prevent the situation from occurring. The fact of the matter is the tests are designed to be used at room temperature. So they say, the manufacturer, QuickVue, says that if you let them thaw to room temperature on a gradual basis, and then you choose to use them, they should be fine. And we've heard reports from people who've been using these and had the same concerns, and they reported correct results. Now, the biggest point to make, and this is the one that you need to obviously, anytime you get an over-the-counter test, you need to read the instructions very carefully so you know how to interpret your result and not be mistaken thinking you do or don't have COVID. The bottom line is they all come with a line that turns a color when you're positive, but also what's called a control line. And the control line is something that helps assure you that you actually did the test correctly. So if you are seeing either evidence for a positive or negative test on your result, you need to know that the control line is showing up. If that does not show up, it means the test is invalid. So if there were a concern that the cold temperature had somehow destroyed the ability of the kit that you have to give you an accurate result, the control line should be impacted, and you won't see that control line. So use that as a guide to helping you feel more confident in what the result turns out to be.
So just to reiterate there, Dr. Levine, that control line isn't just catching, you know, user error around how you did the nasal swab. It also is effectively telling us whether or not the cold could have potentially affected the quality of the test.
Or any other factor affected the quality of the test.
Okay. All right. Let's keep going with the calls. They are coming in. And if you have more questions, you can call us too at 800-639-2211. Let's go now to Lee in Burlington. Lee, you are on the air. Go ahead.
Yes, thanks very much. My spouse has lymphoma and received her 3rd dose of the COVID vaccine 5 months ago. She's 70 years old, by the way. The Leukemia and Lymphoma Society recommends that people with blood cancers get a 4th dose of the COVID vaccine 5 months after their 3rd dose. The CDC also, on its website, suggests a 4th vaccine dose for immunocompromised adults after their 3rd dose. My spouse's oncologist at UVMMC also recommends that she get a 4th vaccine dose after her 3rd vaccine. Despite this, 3 pharmacies in Burlington told me last week they won't give my spouse the 4th dose because the CDC hasn't given formal approval for a 4th dose. Is it correct that the CDC has not approved a 4th dose for immunocompromised adults? And is there some way we can get a 4th dose for my spouse?
Lee, thank you for your question. Dr. Levine, would love to hear your thoughts on the 4th dose, especially for immunocompromised compromised Vermonters.
Right. So that is the situation where the CDC has allowed for a fourth dose in the immunocompromised. So if you're just looking for ability to give a fourth dose in general, like the country of Israel just started doing in those age 60 and older and in those immunocompromised, you won't find that in this country. But for the immunocompromised specifically, you should be able to get that. I'm not sure why having so much trouble with the pharmacies. I would recommend registering on one of our sites and getting the vaccine through one of our state sites, because I'm sure that you'll be able to effectively do that on the registration site.
All right. Thank you, Lee, for your call. Let's go now to Michelle in Washington, Vermont. Michelle, you are on the air. Go ahead.
Hi. So my comment was for the person that called in and said, you know, why aren't we doing more to prevent COVID or to treat COVID, you know, before they end up in the hospital? So I'm a home health and hospice worker, a nurse. And I've got to say that we do a lot behind the scenes that I think people aren't seeing. You know, the doctors are calling us into homes so people don't need to be exposed and go into the doctor's offices and go into the hospitals, doing blood draws in the homes. People who may be mildly sick, we're seeing them in the home to prevent them from getting worse. And a lot of the Medicare rules have changed where the doctors can do more telehealth visits. Even we could do nurse phone visits at one point, or limit our time in the home and do the rest of them outside of the home to prevent a lot of these people with comorbidities from having to expose themselves and, you know, treating what symptoms we can at home before they do end up in the ICU. And I just think that we're not giving everyone credit for everything that they're doing and all the doctors that are preventing them from going in. It's not all just about insurance money or getting paid for a visit. We're doing a lot to try to stop them from going to the hospital to start with.
And Michelle, if I could keep you on the line for just a second, I would love to hear a bit more about what your experiences have been as a nurse and hospice worker right now. I imagine it's been very difficult work, but as you said, you and your colleagues are doing a lot to keep people out of hospitals. What have some of your recent experiences been like?
Well, I myself have had COVID recently, and I'm immune compromised from MS, but the rules keep changing. So the CDC says 5 days without symptoms now. So that even gives us a little bit of anxiety, but I will say probably Dr. Levine would agree, like our test was negative after 5 days. We're safe to be around people. But we still have wounds. We still have people that need us. And if they have COVID, we still need to go into the homes and see them. So, you know, we're doing full PPE and doing our best to go in and take care of them. It's hard to hear people say, you know, that they don't feel like they need to be vaccinated. And then I see a 40-year-old who was hiking Mount Washington, you know, in the fall, and now he can't hike up his stairs to the bathroom because he can't breathe because he ended up on a ventilator and decided not to get vaccinated. It's a lot to see, and it's frustrating to see people who don't want to be vaccinated. I understand it's their right, but if they saw the results, and neurologically, I've seen people who are not the same after COVID and, you know, ICU stays mentally. They're not the same people. They've lost memory.
Well, Michelle, thank you so much for calling in and sharing your experiences with us. Dr. Levine, I have two questions that just came in by email. The first one is around COVID cases in Vermont and how many of them are attributable to the Omicron variant. And then the second, a listener named Paul asked us, what happened to the other strains like the Delta variant? Are they gone? Can people get both variants at the same time? So talk us through these different variants we're seeing.
Sure. Let me again, though, thank Michelle for calling in. And if there's a major take-home message, two messages from what she said. Number one, vaccination, because we know about long COVID and who would want that. And number two, if you're in a high-risk group, there is plenty of supportive care, as she pointed out, that she and others provide. But you need to inform your healthcare professional so that if you qualify for one of these treatments, you can obtain one of them. Very critical. I want to thank her for her service as well. And we opened the hour talking about the hospitals, and we neglected to mention the fact that the biggest stress on the hospital now is not on the number of beds that are available. It's in the number of healthcare workers who are available, because so many have come down with illness and their workforce is significantly challenged. So hats off to all of them. With regard to the questions you just provided, mm-hmm. first of all, we're in the 99.something% of all of the current cases being identified are Omicron variant. So that's almost 100%. With regard to the other variants like Delta, they've been pretty much suppressed and overwhelmed by Omicron. So this one is the one being transmitted person to person, and we're just not seeing the others at all. That doesn't mean they've disappeared from the planet, but the reality is, you know, when we started seeing Delta, we weren't seeing a lot of the former variants. And now that we're seeing Omicron, we're not seeing Delta or the former variants. Although I would submit that some of the hospitalizations that we're seeing still and some of the deaths that we've seen most recently are most likely related to Delta, because they are, of course, these are lagging indicators that would occur weeks after someone first contracted the virus. The fear, of course, is that Omicron may not be the last variant. We hope it'll be the last variant for a while, but the reality is we've seen what's happened. And until we really get the worldwide and total U.S. vaccination rates much higher than they are, we are at risk of seeing more variants develop over time.
Oh, it's hard to even think about another variant when we're still stuck in the middle of this surge. Makes the stomach hurt a bit. Let's switch tacks here a bit, because we haven't had much of a chance yet, Dr. Levine, to talk about children and schools and the state response to COVID spreading in schools. And I believe we have a question about vaccinations amongst children from Christine in Milton. Christine, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call. I have a child who is 12 years old, and they had both doses of the vaccine, so fully vaccinated, and both doses were administered through the State of Vermont clinics. But their account, if you will, their online account that I manage, is only showing one, and we're struggling to prove that they're fully vaccinated. And I'm wondering, what's the best department or number to call to clear that up?
Dr. Levine?
Yeah, if you could leave your information with the VPR staff and we can get it from them, we can look into this. I can't give you just one number or one person, but we can make the connection and get back to you.
All right, Christine, if you can stay on the line after this, we'll be sure to connect you with Dr. Levine later on. We have an email from Laura who says that a non-medically trained friend says she's done hours of daily research and found reputable European sources reporting that people who have been vaccinated are more likely to contract the Omicron variant than unvaccinated people. Dr. Levine, can you weigh in on that claim?
I'm not sure I can weigh in on that claim specifically, though I have heard things like that. I think part of the reality of Omicron is that while it can, as we say it, evade the immune response, meaning you can get a positive test or you could actually have a mild illness with it, you are still very, very protected from the serious outcomes. And if you're in a situation where there is a large, large population of people who have been vaccinated, we're going to see a higher percentage of those people end up getting Omicron, even if they have more of a mild illness, much like what happens with other respiratory viruses like the flu every year, where people still get the illness, but they're spared from some of the complications and serious outcomes from the illness. That's about the best I can do to answer that part.
Well, Dr. Levine, we only have about a minute left with you, but I did want to ask you about the supply of tests for schools since the state is rolling out this new test at home program. We have been hearing that some schools don't have enough antigen tests yet to hand out to families and to staff. Is the state on it? Is that going to change in the next couple of days?
It exactly is going to change in the next couple of days. And in fact, we got several hundred thousand tests delivered today. But we've been actually been delivering through to the schools through the end of last week, and that will continue this week. They're going to see a lot more tests than they've had previously by the end of this week. And our whole test at home program that we've been really working with the schools on is going to really bloom starting as this week goes on, for sure.
Vermont Health Commissioner Dr. Mark Levine, thank you so much for joining the show again today.
My pleasure. Thank you.